This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
And it's my pleasure to now move on to introduce Malcolm McKinnon, who will moderate this morning's panel discussion. Malcolm is an artist, filmmaker and producer, working mainly in the realms of social history and multimedia, particularly on projects in different parts of regional Australia. For One River, Malcolm has worked as curator of stories. I think a fabulous title, actually, one I'm going to try and claim. He's worked as curator of stories, part of the role of which has involved convening a series of critical symposia presented at various stages throughout the year-long life of the project. Please join me in welcoming Malcolm.
Thank you, Kirsten, for that excellent introduction into particularly the interests of the museum in the Murray-Darling Basin. And it's great to be here today working with the museum to present this symposium, because there are such fantastic synergies between the work that you're engaged in on an ongoing basis and our concerns through this really a fleeting project, but a project, as we, as Robin has alluded, that we hope has some real legacy, both in an institutional sense and also in local communities where activity has happened all across the Murray-Darling Basin. Just let me switch slideshows here from one to the other. Okay, so let me first of all thank you all personally for coming along to this session this morning. This is the third and final of our symposia that we're running in the course of the One River project. We ran one in Goolwa in October last year, one in Mildura in March, and this is the final one of those. There's a few people in the audience who have actually a perfect attendance record at Bev Groden, for one, who I was giving a special gold star to before. But whether you've been to all three or just this is the first one, thank you very much for coming along. And we promise you this morning a stimulating program of, in fact, not just this morning, but throughout the whole day, a stimulating program of discussion with a range of illustrious presenters who I'll be introducing in turn. And this afternoon also some presentations from museum curators and also from some of the artists who have been involved in producing work across the Murray-Darling Basin as part of the One River Project, which is, for those of you who are not aware, a kind of multifarious and broad-ranging beast that has, at its heart, had 10 local art projects at different places, ranging from Augathella in the north down to Goolwa at the mouth of the river and many places in between. And there was a reprise or a representation of those at Belconnen that many of you saw yesterday. But also there's been a radio play, there's been the creation of little films that I've made, a photography project, a website, all manner of things, including these symposia. So today we're looking at the Murray-Darling Basin as one of the perennial hot potatoes, in a political sense, in Australian cultural life, that there are debates about the Murray-Darling Basin as a contested space and as a space of conflicting visions that go back certainly to Federation, and they come around with a kind of an amazing consistency. It's one of these great examples in Australian culture of a kind of perpetual amnesia in many ways, the way that we seem to have an argument and then forget that we've had it, have it again in almost exactly the same terms sometimes, many times over. And we'll be looking at that phenomena, but also looking at this fundamental question about this particular historical juncture that we're at now and whether we might be at some point of significant change, perhaps, and different speakers will have their own views on that. I'm asking all of the people that are speaking today to identify themselves in relation to the Murray-Darling Basin, and Robin and Kirsten have done that in the courses of what they've been saying. As Robin alluded to, I have a family connection to the Murray River near Mildura. This is my grandmother in the back row of this photograph. This is a photograph taken in 1920 in the Murray River at Mildura. My grandmother was born at King's Billabong near Mildura in 1904, and her father was had the good fortune to be in Mildura with the Chafee brothers before that, when a small number of people made a large amount of money pretty rapidly in setting up the irrigation colony. I myself was spent the first part of my life in the Sunraysia. Here's me as a very urbane, sophisticated infant swimming in the river in February 1963 with my mother. This is at a river beach near Mildura. And I spent the best years of my childhood visiting my grandparents' fruit block at Redcliffe's, and I still have an ongoing connection. So, like Robin, I think I have this kind of river water in my shoes, or sometimes I think perhaps in my blood. And there are many people like that. In fact, probably the most notable thing about the One River Project, I think, through all of its components, including the local projects, is the way that it's mined this very deep connection and sense of imaginative connection that people have with the river in all sorts of places. So what I wanted to do now is actually just show you a little 3-minute video that I've cut together from the work that I've done making little films across the Murray-Darling Basin. And this is a collection of responses to the question I asked most of the people that I met about their understanding of this term, One River. And I'm showing you this because I think it illustrates the kind of common wisdom that Robin was referring to and Kirsten was referring to from a range of different people in a range of different places. So I'll show that to you now.
We can connect ourselves to our neighbours and connect our stories and have them forevermore. Just a story that might go back 100 years is a valuable story, and a story that goes back a couple of thousand years, the value, you can't put money on that type of story. When you pick up water, you can't pick up water and hold it in your hands and see a sense of money. There's no dollars there. It's just a bit of water that runs through your fingers. So I think that's the way we need to understand it. It's not ours, but it's ours in a sense to share for everybody.
When you talk to people about their river, they often blame people up the just immediately up them for the problems. Well, we've all got shared problems, I guess. But I notice that, you know, I've had a bit to do with people just down below Cubby and etc., and all the way the Mindy Lakes and right down to the Murray itself. And it's amazing how they always seem to blame people just above them for their problems. I think the sooner we realise it's all one river and we've all got a shared interest in it, the better we'll be.
It's the river that sustains us all, so the water that comes from that river keeps us all going, and we have to manage it like it's part of our heart and part of our life and part of our whole family. So we have to care about what's happening in other areas. So we have to make sure the whole system's healthy. Like everybody, we're all concerned about where we live.
Like this river, it starts out, it's got the McIntyre coming in, it's got the Gwydir coming in, it's got the Mee coming in. That's only the New South Wales side. Then on the Queensland side, you've got the Weir River coming in, you've got the Moonee coming in, and then down further, you've got the Culgoa and the Pukara going into it. Then you've got Warrego and Paroo and all those going into it, so it's all connected to one river.
People who base their lives around fishing, and riverboat captains, and people who just like have favourite swimming spots, and a whole range of people. And the consistent thing has been this this depth of what I call common wisdom, and also a kind of imaginative capacity to appreciate the inevitable changing nature of the river, and the fact that in fact the world that the worlds that people are attached to, the places that people are attached to, are intricately connected with a whole range of other places. And what's struck me again and again is how that kind of common wisdom is such at such a distinct remove from the politicised and technocratic language of so much policy, which I think is a real challenge for anyone that works in policy. Working in policy is not an easy realm, and I don't mean to be critical out of hand, but there is this incredible kind of disconnect between this a kind of emotional intelligence and an imaginative intelligence that we encounter on the ground and the kind of technocratic, politicised dialogue that goes on in the public realm. And we need to kind of bridge that divide, I think, in lots of ways. And in saying this, I'm mindful that here we are in Canberra in the middle of a federal election. And it's very interesting, I think, the man who is tipped to be Australia's next Prime Minister describing himself as a conservationist in a national debate the other day on the basis that he's been bushwalking a couple of times. But I'm also mindful of the fact that this is the same bloke who the journalist Annabel Crabb describes the exuberant simplicities of Tony Abbott, which I think is an excellent description of what passes for political dialogue, not just from Tony Abbott, although he is a master exponent of the exuberant simplicity. But I'm also aware of the kind of the short-sighted notion of someone like Tony Abbott saying, Tony Abbott himself, in fact, saying only 2 years ago, why would we need to be developing a plan to return water to the river when there's a flood? You know, what's going on here? You know, I mean, give us a break, for God's sake. We're not that stupid. And there is a real kind of intelligence which I think is undervalued consistently in the political realm, and it's not good enough, and we should be demanding more, I would say. To that end, I just want to show you another slide here by way of just injecting some sense of urgency into what we're talking about today, because sometimes it seems as though if we're not in the middle of a 10-year drought or we're not in the middle of a blue-green algae outbreak on the Darling, that we don't have this sense of crisis or urgency. And we do, I think. This is a photograph taken only a few years ago towards the end of the drought down where you come from, Moogie, actually down in the Coorong, where there was this issue of Murray River turtles being encased in a kind of coral crustacean that made it impossible for them to survive, and in fact they were frequently attacked by predators. And there was an episode there where a number of community groups, including the school at Malang, ran a kind of turtle rescue program and went through the painstaking work of chipping these coral crustaceans off these turtles and rehabilitating them to eventually return to the river when the water eventually became more habitable. But just this week, when I was flying up here on Thursday, I was reading in the Weekly Times, which is the Victorian rural press publication, about how the Murray crayfish has just been put on the list of species in danger of extinction, critical danger of extinction. So, you know, if we consider all these things to be collateral damage and we accept all those things, then that's all well and good. But I think many of us would feel uneasy about doing that. And these issues are they're issues that are real crisis issues that we have to deal with. And the fact that, you know, we have rain in the water in the Yume at the moment is fantastic. But, of course, there are these cycles that go on all the time, and we would do well to learn from our histories. So that's what we're on about today. And the real question, as I said before, is to look at the way the Murray-Darling Basin is this recurrent political hot potato, and the way that we have these repetitive arguments that often come down to sectoral interests fighting against each other, and sometimes I think a kind of oversimplified notion of environmental restoration or preservation versus economic imperatives. And that's it's a very unproductive kind of way of looking at the argument. And I think that many people can see a lot more common ground, and we have to be doing that. And that's what we're looking at today in a range of different ways. And looking at whether, as I said before, we might be at a moment now, a juncture in time, where we can start to see some significant shifts in our ability to manage things, in spite of all the evidence to the contrary. I mean, there are state governments that are busy obstructing national agreements at the moment to do with the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. But let's hope that we might be able to work beyond that. And implicit in this is the question of where leadership comes from. And I think leadership comes from a whole lot of places that are not necessarily offices in Canberra. They come from all sorts of places across the basin. And some of the people speaking today are actively providing that kind of leadership. So, we're pleased to have an excellent range of speakers who can address this topic. And the first of them is Daniel Connell, who is a historian, a teacher, a public policy analyst based at the Australian National University. Daniel's written extensively about Murray-Darling Basin politics and policy issues, including a book called Water Politics in the Murray-Darling Basin. And Daniel has a particular interest in governance issues relating to rivers that span and divide different political constituencies, both in Australia and internationally. So please welcome Daniel Connell. I'll get this set up for you.
Yes, the theme that I'm going to be talking about this morning is that of communities, and basically I'll be talking about how that's really been at the centre of the whole development debate about the Murray-Darling Basin for, I guess, 150 years. How do you create communities? How do you protect them? How do you develop them? And what are the purposes of these communities, and what are the interests that they represent? And I argue that it's much more diverse than we normally think. Now, how does this work?
So just any of those buttons will move to the next slide, that's right.
Okay, so I can't get a full slide there.
No, you've got a little keyframe, but can you see
that? Yep, sure, that's fine. Okay, one of the perennial discussions is the role of irrigation. Irrigation is central to the way in which the debate about the Murray-Darling Basin has been conducted over the last 120 years. But what I'm wanting to argue is that there's a lot more involved than irrigation. Irrigation is really important. I don't want to suggest that it's not. Opposition of irrigation, environment, etc., I think is a very unproductive sort of conflict. As you all know, the Murray-Darling Basin extends far into the southern Queensland, and as we were hearing at the beginning from Robin, it's very much a federal story. It's a very central story to the history of the Australian national development from the point of view of South Australia in particular. It was probably, it was certainly one of the most important issues, and for many South Australians, the most important issue that caused them to be interested in federation. And so we've got an area with four different states and the Australian Capital Territory, and then in addition to that, the national government itself. So we've actually got six jurisdictions that are conflicting about how this area should be managed and should be developed. But central, as I say, is the fact that it's one basin, and somehow or other we need to try and assert that and work out practical ways to turn that vision into something that influences what happens in policy and happens in management. As we all know, we saw before the paddle steamers. This was originally the first reason for the Murray-Darling Basin to be developed, and South Australia, Adelaide, had this dream of seeing itself as the New Orleans on the Mississippi. I grew up in South Australia, went to university in Adelaide. The idea of Adelaide as New Orleans, it's a very attractive idea. It wasn't the one I experienced, although we did have the Adelaide Festival, which was beginning to head that way. But this is a very important sort of phase. We tend to think of it as something that's in the dim past, but actually out of that early period when people were concerned about trying to, particularly South Australia, about trying to get the area sort of shaped with weirs and barrages, etc., so that it would be suitable for navigation, we actually put in place an infrastructure that is no longer relevant to having paddle steamers commercially going up and down streams in the Murray-Darling Basin. But communities throughout the Murray-Darling Basin have built themselves around the particular shape that the river has taken around that infrastructure. And so that infrastructure and that period still continues to have a very big impact on the way in which people live in the Murray-Darling Basin. Alfred Deakin, we know of him as Australia's second Prime Minister and one of the most important people in writing the Constitution, but his first great cause was the cause of irrigation in Victoria when he was a young minister in his early 30s in the Victorian colonial state government or colonial government. And this particular cartoon shows him in his campaign to transform the area and use a fairly large amount of state money to transform northern Victoria. As you can see, when you look at this cartoon, and it's obviously, you know, drawing on the biblical references that would have meant been obvious to people at the time. This is Moses striking the rock and providing water to his people. The cartoonist, obviously with a sardonic sort of touch, you can see down there on the lower right, the public purse is also being struck. So there was a big debate about the amount of money that was going to go into this. But the idea that Deakin had was that water wasn't just something about pipes and channels and things like that. He saw it as a way to create communities within the Murray-Darling Basin that where you'd have a large number of people all closely living together with independent sort of smallholder lots. He saw this as the foundation for the democracy that Victoria was very much very proud of in terms of the way in which it was leading the way in terms of all sorts of innovations. And the idea of creating, not having pastoralists and people like that with their tendencies to pull the system back into a very hierarchical bunyip aristocracy type system with the Western District and things like that, he saw irrigation as a way of bringing a new type of person into the political system of Victoria. And he also saw it as a way of bringing urban civilization. He was a very urban-orientated person, and he saw this as a way of creating centres within the Murray-Darling Basin, centres along the river that had all the civic qualities and the civilised qualities of urban areas. He was very sort of dismissive of what was involved in rural life in the pastoral sense. He was responsible for bringing out, played a very big role in the Chaffee brothers coming out, and they established some of the first and most important communities in terms of their numbers and influence, Renmark and Mildura, in Victoria and South Australia. And I always like this particular sort of illustration, which comes from a history of Mildura. That's one of the Chaffee brothers, and he looks very like the sort of illustrations that you'd see of Mao and Stalin in the 1920s and 30s. And it's interesting, these sort of super life figures, basically leading their people and playing this sort of command and control type role, establishing these colonies along the river. And you can see in that group, you can see quite a few returned servicemen, all those sorts of people. I mean, this is very much part of the nation-building story of Australia. And one of the things that I think is very important is to understand their place in that nation story, because when you look at some of the feeling that has been in the debate about water in the Murray-Darling Basin over the last 10, 20 years, there's a strong sense of betrayal in those river communities about the way in which they're being portrayed in the national press as destructive of the environment and things like that. For 100 years, they were very much taught to see themselves as part of the process of creating a settled European-style Australia, for better or worse. That's the way they saw themselves. And so there's a strong sense of betrayal when they see the national connection. But one of the things that I'm wanting to argue in my talk this morning is that we do need to move beyond that particular vision of the sort of the appropriate types of communities in the Murray-Darling Basin. We do need to think of it as a place which is much more diverse and which has communities with a much wider interest than just irrigation. The river that we know is actually very different from the river that existed for thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of years. And just to get an idea of the variability and of the older river, the pre-Hume Dam River, the pre-regulated river. Here's a photograph of a small dam that's been put across the river in South Australia to try and get a little bit of extra depth into the river so that they can continue to sort of drain water out of it for some of the irrigation pumps that are along the way. And it just gives you an idea of how, at particular times, you can have very low flow. One of the other things that's very interesting about this particular photograph is that at this time, this is the drought of 1914, Morgan, which has been the place where they measure salinity along the Murray-Darling Basin, and it's the sort of the standard measure that has been used for a very long period of time, Morgan at this stage hit salinity levels of over 10,000 ECs. Now, 2,500 ECs, people can drink for very brief periods. Basically, 10,000 ECs, it's not possible to use that as drinking water for, you know, for people or for animals or for plants or in any sort of way. But it just shows that, you know, left to itself, the river is a very variable sometimes hostile force. Hume Dam is the major storage on the river, which has transformed it and which has made it possible to provide water security for communities and for industry and for a whole lot of activities right down the river. It's the iconic and central and strategic sort of storage. And this really has been a major part of the story. And so, you know, in a sense, it was the building of Hume Dam completed in the 1930s, which transformed the river and made it the river that we now know today, for better or worse. We've been through a period of enormous expansion through the 20th century, but come the 1970s, 1980s, it clearly began to be, we'd clearly got to the limits of the sort of development that we were undertaking and getting away with those sorts of developments and still having a reasonable river. Now, I've put this photograph up. This is a photograph of Malang Jetty, and I grew up in Strathalbyn. We've been asked to sort of talk about our personal connections with the river. I spent a lot of my time as a teenager canoeing on this lake, Lake Alexandrina, and swimming where you can see the grass now. That's where I used to swim as a child. And this area was and still is in many ways, but not as much as it used to be, a beautiful sort of place of an enormous significance to me. Now, it was an area, of course, that before they built the barrages, again, that was a period which I didn't experience. That was in the 1940s. That absolutely transformed that area, and maybe we'll hear a bit more a bit later about life on the Coorong and that sort of area. But this particular photograph, I've put it up as a, in a sense, it represents the limits of whenever you want to take more out of the Murray, you just allocate more or you just increase the development pressure. Effectively, what this photograph means for me is recognition that we'd come to the absolute outer limits and gone way beyond them in terms of development pressure, and further use of the river basically required increasingly sophisticated, smart management. That's the crisis that we've been in for the last 20 or 30 years. We're talking about how should the river be managed? What does sustainability mean? One of the things that, sustainability is very much like that, Lord, make me good, but not yet. But when you think about a long-term development strategy for the Murray-Darling Basin, there comes a point where ongoing decline, and that's what we've been operating on for most of the 20th century, is not a rational basis for long-term planning. So at some stage, you have to stabilise and say, OK, they're the limits we're going to work within. Well, they're the limits that we hit 20 or 30 years ago. And that's what a lot of this debate that's been happening about the basin plan and environmental purchasing water for to improve environmental conditions. That's what that debate has been about. Community consultation. This has become a very well-known photograph of what happened at Griffith. Effectively, the process of trying to develop a more diverse notion of what should be happening in the Murray-Darling Basin has been a very painful process. And it's quite reasonable and appropriate that that people express themselves strongly and argue their case. But essentially, when we look at the whole idea of taking water back from the over-allocation that's taken place over the last 100 years and reallocating it to the environment and all sorts of other cultural uses, what we're talking about is restoring and protecting the communities where people live. It's very important, I think, when you think about purchases for the environment and you think about water for the environment, that you not see it as production versus the environment as some sort of alien, anti-people type thing. Effectively, water for the environment means protecting the areas where people live. It means making them continue to be attractive places to live. It means protecting the values that exist in those places. And this is the last slide that I just want to finish on. This is Mildura. And I've only got one slide that I've put there along with it because I just wanted to sort of pose. I didn't want to make the story too sort of diverse and complex and confused. I just wanted to sort of just bring forward one of the alternative sort of values that need to be taken into account. These communities, for example, are no longer just irrigation communities. They're communities where a lot of people live who could live somewhere else. A lot of retired people live along the river. And my argument is that if we basically were to allow continuing expansion of irrigation and allow these communities, allow the river to degrade, we'd effectively be turning these places into very unattractive places to live. Now, what that translates into is population movement. People who are retired can retire wherever they like, and it means that these places would sort of shrink in size, and that would have enormous economic impacts. Now, that's just an economic argument for why we need to take a diverse approach to thinking about communities along the Murray-Darling Basin. But I'm sort of forced into this economic perspective rather against my will, because there are also many other aesthetic and cultural things that are also extremely important that need to be taken into account and that we need to preserve along the Murray-Darling Basin system. Okay.
Thank you very much, Daniel. I think there's a nice little heretical streak, actually, in what Daniel was saying, which I think is good, because the reality is, of course, is that if we are at some point of genuine change, then it does mean some fundamental attitudinal shifts. And there is all sorts of, you know, traumatic change going on, and we have to engage with that, I think, in a productive way and not just hope that things will return to some, you know, idealised vision, water being turned into gold, as Chafee was gesticulating across the environment, that things need to shift. And we need to question some of the prevailing stories and myths that have got us to where we are now. Okay, moving along. The next speaker I want to introduce is Sarah Moles, who said that I could also refer to her, if I liked, as the purple-spotted gudgeon, also known as the purple-spotted gudgeon from the Darling Downs, with her spectacular hair colour that will come up very nicely under the lights, I'm sure. Sarah's here all the way from southwest Queensland. And Sarah is one of those people who does a lot of hard work on a lot of different committees to look at management of natural resources in her part of the world and across the Murray-Darling Basin more broadly. And I want to pay tribute to Sarah as one of those people, because it's a real slog, I think, a lot of that work. And it's unglamorous, and it requires going to a lot of meetings and sometimes asking yourself, are we getting anywhere with this stuff, which is really what I've asked Sarah to speak about. So I'll just mention some of the work that Sarah's involved in, informed by her passion for freshwater environments. She's a member of the Community Advisory Committee to the... she was a member of the Community Advisory Committee to the former Murray-Darling Basin Ministerial Council and the Living Murray Community Reference Group. She's currently a director of the Queensland Murray-Darling Basin Committee and the Ethos Foundation, a member of two Great Artesian Basin advisory groups, and also a fellow of the Australian Rural Leadership Foundation. As well as that, Sarah and her partner, Michael, a few years ago, travelled down the Darling River and produced an excellent book called The Dying Darling, an illustrated book about stories about the health of that river. So please welcome Sarah Moles. I'll get you started here.
Thanks, Malcolm. Good morning, everyone. I'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners before we start, and also the traditional owners of the land where I live, which is Gitabal country. I'm from the Darling Downs. This first slide, actually, I put a little blue dot on it to show you where I come from. I wasn't actually born in Australia. I came here in the late 60s. I'm a Navy brat, and as a result of being posted all around the world, really didn't have any roots at all until my husband and I and our then young son moved to the Darling Downs in 1987. So I've lived there for about half of my life, which is an eye blink in the terms of the timescales that Indigenous people talk about their connection to country in. But my connection to country is deeply important to me. I'm a riparian landholder in the Upper Condamine. I live about as far from the mouth of the Murray as you can get and still be in the Murray-Darling Basin. I can see the watershed from my kitchen window. And that connection is why I do all the greeny stuff that I do. I find water to be an incredibly emotional thing. I have an intrinsic understanding that without water there is no life, that it's the driving force of all nature. And that's why I get involved in all these exceedingly bureaucratic committees and occasionally bang my head on desks wondering why are we getting anywhere, will we ever get anywhere. But I don't want to make you think from the start that this is going to be terribly negative. We have gone places, but by God, it's hard work. I'm originally a photographer. I don't actually have any formal training in any of this natural resource management stuff. Did I just flick two? By dint of becoming a riparian landholder and suddenly discovering that, oh, my God, you can't just sit here and let it happen. You actually have to manage this stuff, including the creek that happens to run through your property, I found as many opportunities as I could to learn about the issues, about natural resources. And it's been my great privilege to work with some fantastic people in government departments, people who are scientists, particularly ecologists, people who study salinity, vegetation, all kinds of really fascinating things. So although I certainly don't consider myself an expert in any of it, I have an overarching interest and passion for freshwater conservation. And I spent three separate incarnations working for the Worldwide Fund for Nature on wetland conservation in the Murray-Darling Basin. And I suspect that, you know, the sum total of all that experience was something that gave me enough credibility and enough, you know, credible things on my CV that led to my being appointed to the Murray-Darling Basin Commission's Community Advisory Committee, and as a result of that, onto the Living Murray Community Reference Group. Now, that's going back a ways. The first step must have started in about 2003 or 2004, but please don't quote me on the numbers. And my first observation of as a Queensland representative on the CAC was, what the hell has this got to do with Queensland? All we ever talk about is the Murray River. Not that I didn't think that was important, I just wondered why the hell Queensland was engaging in this process that really didn't have anything in it for Queensland. That was about the time that governments, not including Queensland, had committed $1 billion to restoring the health of the Living Murray, of choosing those icon sites, the Ramsar wetlands along the river and the River Murray Channel, and really working hard to buy back water and to hit targets and improve the health of those rivers, and particularly the vegetation communities. We had red gum forests dying all over the Murray-Darling Basin, dire straits of, you know, it had been far too long before we'd had colonial waterbird breeding events. Those sort of environmental alarm bells were just really ringing. And here I am, perched at the top of the Darling and having been to some wonderful places in the Paroo wetlands and down the Darling to Menindee and the Gwydir wetlands and all kinds of fabulous places if you happen to like wetlands, which I do. And I was deeply frustrated that the Darling was just completely missing in this whole conversation that was going on. It was just so far off. It wasn't even in the ballpark. And it was really a matter of great frustration. And I talked about it to my husband, partner, lifelong pal, who is a very competent artist, about, you know, how about we do a project together and do something about the Darling? Instead of staying home to look after the chooks while I go off to all these fantastic places, how about you come out and meet some of these people and do their portraits, draw their landscapes, and I'll write a narrative. And so the Dying Darling was the result. Living Murray, Dying Darling, because it just wasn't on the radar. But it was a really excellent process to go through because it enriched my understanding. I'm unashamedly, I'm a photographer by training, but I'm a greenie, an environmentalist by inclination. And this whole process of going and talking to people, interviewing people, we made a conscious decision to visit each of the major catchments in the Darling and to talk to irrigators, to talk to floodplain graziers, dryland farmers, local government people, Indigenous people, and cover as many, as broad a range of views and interests and sectors that are present in the Darling Basin as possible to give a, you know, a kind of a rounded picture of what was actually going on. And Michael was kind enough to say, OK, I'll stick my hand up and be the naive observer and I'll be the person who asks the stupid questions. And I'm like, oh, hang on, honey, there aren't any stupid questions. This is really complicated. But he did take on that role very willingly and he asked some very good questions. And he said to me one day as we were driving home from Bourke, you know, I thought the answer to this big problem that we're facing in the Darling Basin was going to be really obvious. It was just going to be irrigation. Too much water's been taken out of it for irrigation, end of story. And I've realised if only it were that simple. It's much more complicated than that, and indeed it is. Writing The Dying Darling, I live and work in a world populated by bureaucrats and scientists, and mostly bureaucrats. And I guess I've become a bit of a policy wonk and I'm quite comfortable with bureaucratic jargon and language that I think they use deliberately to mystify people and make themselves really sound important, that we, you know, deal with all this really complicated stuff that you plebs down there don't understand. Trying to transcribe what my interview subjects had told me without distorting their words gave me the most agonising case of writer's block. I had no idea what it was like. It is physically painful. And I had to just throw it away, put it aside for a while and just go and do something else, anything else. And I spent a lot of time sitting down on the creek in tears. Oh, God, I'm never going to write this stuff. And I ended up cutting a whole lot of rushes and reeds, dismantling an old bush gate, and I built a canoe out of barbed wire and lamandra leaves, which became part of the touring exhibition that Michael's work eventually became. And I called it The State of the Darling, and the little didactic for it says State of the Darling, barbed wire, lamandra leaves, brackets, no paddle, because I really thought at the time that we were up the proverbial creek in a dreadful canoe and no means of getting ourselves out of this dilemma. So that's a little bit about me and where I'm coming from. One of the things Malcolm asked me to do was to reflect on the kinds of alliances that have been formed between environmentalists and other sectors in this long, difficult history that we've had that has led us to the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. And very early on, environmentalists from the peak groups, ACF, Environment Victoria, New South Wales Nature Conservation Council, etc., etc., those groups who were active in the Murray-Darling Basin, formed an alliance. Our obvious allies were the floodplain graziers, who many of whom we had met through processes like the Living Murray Community Reference Group and the local committees and so on. And those people were really struggling because the extent of over-allocation upstream from them meant that the country that they had specifically chosen in many cases to purchase for a grazing operation, precisely because it was regularly inundated, were no longer getting any of those floods. So they were very thoroughly across the whole notion of what an environmental flow does in terms of productive grazing and even in some cases productive dryland agriculture, because a decent flood would give them sufficient soil moisture to keep their grasses growing or to provide a soil, a storage of water for a couple of years at least of decent crops or decent pastures to raise their cattle on. So they were the obvious initial allies. Slightly less obvious were the shooters and fishing community. And people would raise their eyebrows and say, how come you greenies are getting into bed with shooters? And the answer is people who like to hunt ducks want water in wetlands because ducks won't go there if there isn't any water. And similarly, people who love to fish need adequate flows at the right time and of the right temperature so that fish breed and fish migrate and fish grow and that there will be fish in rivers for them to catch. So those were the early days of the alliance that environmentalists formed to contribute to the dialogue around how do we get to a place where we can have a Murray-Darling Basin Plan. More recently, that alliance, since the Basin Plan was formed, more recently the alliance has grown. And if you're interested in checking out this website, the lifeblood.org.au website, and it's not on that slide, I couldn't fit the whole thing on one page, but there's a list down the side of all the groups who are involved in the Lifeblood Alliance, and it's actually more extensive and wider than you might think. There are climate and health alliances, people who are concerned that the impacts of climate change are going to have dramatic impacts on human health, and therefore we need to keep water in rivers to keep rivers healthy so that people can be healthy, as we heard from Adrian on Malcolm's slide, Malcolm's little video earlier on. Bird groups, fishing groups, local environment groups, and the environment groups that you would expect. But also farmers are becoming much more organised, and there are now a number of environmental farmers networks across the place. So I think that there will be greater and more extensive alliances formed as we get into implementing the Basin Plan. Now, I had a hiatus of involvement in the Murray-Darling Basin stuff where, between the time when the old commission was dissolved and the authority started, and it's only in the last year or so that I've picked that up again as a member of the Northern Basin Advisory Committee. In the interim, the Lock the Gate Alliance, the campaign against inappropriate coal and coal seam gas mining, took over a big chunk of my life. And Malcolm asked me to reflect on where I thought alliances might go. There are a couple of reasons why the Lock the Gate campaign is relevant to this conversation. The first is that the Lock the Gate Alliance has formed alliances with an extraordinary range of people. Many, 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 many people who are involved in it are farmers. But there's also what I would consider to be quite right-wing groups. Property Rights Australia are involved in the alliance. There are churches, there are lawyers, doctors, nurses, people interested in the impact of toxic chemicals on our environment. It goes on and on and on, and I have no doubt that that will continue to grow. The other reason why the Lock the Gate campaign is relevant to the Murray-Darling Basin is that there's a lot of coal seam gas extraction going on in the northern part of the basin, not so far from where I live. If you know southern Queensland, sort of from Dalby out to nearly to Mitchell, where Jude Roberts' wonderful sculptural paper rolls were immersed in the river. Potentially, there are some serious water quality impacts. If things go wrong and there are spills, we could see quite a lot of very salty water with a whole lot of undesirable contaminants finish up in our rivers, and all that's going to make its way down to Adelaide, as if Adelaide doesn't have water quality problems enough. The other issue is that extracting coal seam gas relies greatly on removing groundwater so that the gas can flow. Our understanding of the degree of connection between groundwater systems and surface water systems in the Murray-Darling Basin is not great. We really do not know what the impacts are going to be. There's an awful lot of salt stored in the water that is being extracted from coal seams. Now, as Malcolm indicated, once upon a time, not so long ago, salinity was the crisis facing the Murray-Darling Basin, and then we moved on to environmental flows, and then we had floods, and in a way, I believe, we're still reeling from one crisis to another. But it seems to me that when we're spending millions, hundreds of millions of dollars a year to deal with salinity across the Murray-Darling Basin, that we should be extremely circumspect about mobilising millions of tonnes of salt and bringing it to the surface of the landscape where it could create further problems and in some cases, places where we don't have that problem at the moment, precisely because the salt is stored out of sight, out of mind and safely below ground. The other deep concern is that in this particular part of Queensland, we're talking about areas, groundwater aquifers that are connected to the Great Artesian Basin, where pressure is an extremely valuable resource. That's another issue, and we don't have time to discuss that today. Nevertheless, we have all this groundwater coming up out of the ground. There's no allocation. The companies can take as much of it as they need, and we're going to have a very interesting water accounting problem at some time in the future, because some of this is being discharged into rivers, and it's all very, very blurry. And when you ask Queensland bureaucrats, at least, on how this is going to be managed, they're then far from clear about what the hell's actually going on and how it will be managed. So I think it's important in this discussion to... I would certainly like to acknowledge that there has been a lot of progress. We have a Water Act, a Commonwealth Water Act, for the first time. We have the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. We have the first draft of an environmental watering plan. We've flagged the constraints to delivering environmental water. We have a constraints management strategy. The new Murray-Darling Basin Authority is listening. That shot of the draft basin plan on fire in Griffith, what a textbook case in how not to do community consultation. That was like watching someone walk backwards into a very rapidly spinning fan. What a disaster. And it set the cause back a long time to patch that up. Trust is so hard to build, but you can blow it so easily. And people are very reluctant to rebuild it quickly after an incident like that. So my sense of where we are at the moment, whilst we've made great progress, is that we are still tending to put all our human-centred needs first, unlike Aboriginal people who put Mother Earth first and work back from there. So these are some things that I think it would do us well to remember as we move forward with the new Murray-Darling Basin Plan. My own view is that we are still putting socioeconomic priorities first. We still tend to put rivers... I think we still tend to see water as a commodity. We tend to value rivers' water as an economic resource before any other, driving force of all nature and all that. It's just not quite gelling for me. At this particular time, with an imminent election, I'm heartened that there has been such bipartisan support, not just for the Water Act, but also the Basin Plan. I am a little concerned when I look back at the Nationals' position, and I wonder how much influence they might have on a coalition government, if that's what we end up with, in terms of wanting to amend the plan so that socioeconomic concerns are primacy again, rather than, you know, the more balanced approach that the authority is trying to deliver now. I certainly understand that we are going to have a system of trade-offs, and we will be trying to balance environmental and social and cultural values and come up with the best compromise, but I'm going to be very alarmed if everything it becomes subservient once again to socioeconomic needs. Above all, I'm very concerned that it's just going to be a political football and we'll kick it around again and we'll go back several years. Fingers crossed for a good outcome there. One of the things that I was on a teleconference maybe 3 weeks ago with members of the Murray-Darling Basin Authority and my Northern Basin Advisory Council colleagues, and we were talking about, or I raised the need for consistent terminology. That's something that we still don't have. The language between Queensland and New South Wales is different. When you add up all the different kinds of water products, the way they're labelled, there's dozens, scores of them, and surely we could simplify that. And I made some comment to the effect that, gosh, wouldn't it be good if we could have one consistent terminology across the whole basin, and there was and guffaws around the room, dream on, Sarah, it will never happen. And I said, hang on, why can it never happen? Oh, it's too hard. Come on, guys. Surely that is not hard. It's a matter of political will. We could agree, could we not, that we will work towards having a consistent terminology across the basin? Doesn't sound to me like a really big deal, just to have an agreement that we would work towards that. What the authority and governments are asking us, the community, to do, that's hard. That's really hard. They're asking us to restructure our communities, but they won't play the game themselves so that everybody, not just people who work in bureaucracy, actually understands what the conversation is about. I don't reckon it's a big deal anyway. So where are we going? There are some things that I think we still need to do. In addition to the consistent terminology across the basin, I think it would be very handy to have a set of coherent and consistent policies. The salinity coal seam gas stuff is an example that sticks in my mind, all the salt and all that. We are going to have to deal with the impacts of climate change somewhere down the track, and no doubt we will have to amend the basin plan at some point in the future. Most of all, though, what I think has been missing from the debate today, and again in Malcolm's video where Adrian was speaking, he talked about the value of water and, you know, it's just water running through your fingers. And for me, that's the debate that we haven't had and that Australia, not just the Murray-Darling Basin, needs to have. What is the real value of water in all its roles and all its functions across the landscape? Not just economic values, but spiritual and cultural and social and environmental. All these things need to be the subject of a very courageous conversation. And I would like to pay tribute to the One River team for cracking that open and allowing us to have a debate that's not framed in bureaucratic jargon, but that's a real conversation amongst real people living in the real world. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sarah, and I especially appreciate the passion that Sarah brings to the debate. And it really does get to the heart of that question that we might discuss a bit later on about where leadership comes from in this instance. And I think that the work that there are people like Sarah all around the country, really, who are devoted and passionate and who are there for the long haul, and they're often the people I think that we need to be looking for more and privileging more in the debate, because, you know, they're doing the hard work, I think. And also they're there to remind us about the things that we say that don't make sense, as Sarah said, which is, I think, terrific. And also to point out the instances of what we would have to call cognitive dissonance, where we say one thing but we behave in a way which is entirely contrary to that in some other aspect of our endeavours, and there's no shortage of examples of that. I should have explained earlier on that the way that we're running this session this morning, going into the afternoon, through until lunchtime, is that there are four speakers. They'll all speak and then they'll come and sit here and we'll have some time for discussion and questions after the last two speakers. So the next of those that I'd like to introduce is Major Sumner, also known to many people as Uncle Moogie, who is a Narrangeri elder from down at the mouth of the river, the Coorong region. Mugi is a teacher and a mentor to many of his people. He has for several years now been working to revive ceremonial journeys, or ringbalan in the Ngarrindjeri language, along vast stretches of the Murray and Darling rivers to summon river spirits and encourage the return of fresh water to depleted and damaged country. And Mugi will talk a bit more about that. But what part of what's interesting about that work is the way that it deliberately draws together different Aboriginal peoples from across the river system. And really, in lots of ways, has become a powerful representation of Indigenous interests across the Murray-Darling Basin. So, Mugi, you've got a little film that... Do you want to talk first, or should we show this little film first?
Yeah, show us a film first, that way I can...
Okay, so we've got this little... I think it's about 6 or 7 minutes long. Yeah. 6 minutes, and then Mugi will speak after that. So, here we go.
Look at the moon. When we're talking about this river, it's a river of life. It gave life to everything, from the Darling right down through to the Murray mouth. We've been going for thousands and thousands of years.
All we have is our dreams.
When people got sick, they'd bring them to the Kurrung and bathe them in the water. It was healing to Ngarrindjeri. That river lasted. It was looked after until about 200 years ago.
It's in you. It's born into you. You know, I might go into Adelaide for a meeting, and I might see some Ngarrindjeri that are living in Adelaide. Hey, Brother Tom, how was my Kurrung? And I say, not too good. I say, not the same Kurrung. Need water. Need water bag to freshen it up again. Now, what they got down there is a big sand dredging machine. I call it a life support machine.
For years, I've been watching this, my part of the country, out as it was dying. When you see things like that, it disturbs you. And it makes you think what we should be doing.
So it was get everyone together, get all the river nations together, and get everyone dancing. I've been thinking about this for a long, long time. There was a need to do ceremony, to dance the spirit back into the lands and the people, from one end of the river to the other.
We kind of got this sense that something big was going to happen. And, of course, you never think it's going to happen in your lifetime, do you?
Oh, geez, we had no money.
Yeah.
I sent the webpage and rang up and mug up. He said, yeah, come on. And we're using our money for our bills.
The ringbalan has been around for thousands and thousands of years, where our people would visit with each other. They visited and they traded, but they also danced and sang songs about the creation of this country.
There's nothing more important to us than to see the water flowing right to the end, down to the mouth of the Murray. That's the most important thing that we have to do in our lifetime.
Hey!
We grew up along the river. We grew up on the lakes. We done all the different cultural things that was handed down to us.
When I was born on Nalman Indian Mission, the river was crystal clear like the beach. You had the yabbies, you had the turtles, you had the mussels, you had everything, as well as the plants that grow along it. And when you see those diminishing, you know there's something's horribly wrong.
everything's out of balance. So until we can learn how to find that balance, we're going to have problems.
When you ask how important the river and the lakes is to us, it's like taking our spirit away from us. You're dead. You're nothing. You got no feeling. That's how important the river is to me and to my grandchildren, to my children.
In the end, you know, it starts to affect your mind and how you think about yourself and who you are. And that's where doubt comes in. And I hope that one thing that we achieve through this ceremony is that, you know, we no longer have a doubt in anyone's minds. That we ourselves don't doubt the importance of our identity and maintaining our identity and who we are as a people.
Bring the people together. That's the most powerful energy you can get, is to bring people together so that we look after this country together.
You could feel it last night when you were dancing. You could feel it, and it was like the spirits were going. This is just one of the best things that's happened to us for a very, very long time. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
This morning I got a couple of phone calls that it's raining in Kubapidi and it's raining in Murray Bridge. It's not just raining, they used a more colourful language when they told me how it was coming down, so we'll leave that for later.
Not just cats and dogs?
Not cats and dogs, no, it was... The knowledge is with us. We know how to look after this place. We've been here for thousands and thousands of years. We're not going anywhere.
The words that keep me alive. For I am since I was a child.
Thank you. Before I start my talk, I'd like to invite our ancestors, but also honour the ancestors and the traditional owners of this land that we stand on here today.
Walkandi. Rika. Ruma. Halka. Ngari, pakan mutano. Ngari, pangari. Lewan, Rui. Ngarairi pakinamotano, ngarairi pangari, lemon rui. Ngarairi pakinamotano, ngarairi pangari, lemon rui. Ngarairi pakinamotano, ngarairi pangari, lemon rui. Ngarairi ngāori andu, ngarairi ngāori andu. Ring all the anduk, ring all the anduk, ring all the anduk.
And I said in my language, I invited the ancestors from the four directions. I invited them to come here, to be here. When I talk about our ancestors, I just don't talk about mine. I talk about all your ancestors, wherever you come from in the world, whatever brought you here to our country. I invite them here too, to be with you. To help us understand each other. Help us understand this country, what we're here about today. Help us think. And help us to speak. All the right things. I invited them here with a song to come and sit amongst us. The spirits of our ancestors to be here with us. The ones that looked after this land before us. And the ones that will be here after we go. Sometimes we join them. And we'll be there looking after this land. I'd like to thank the Murray-Darling Basin and a man that been, he became a friend. Over the last 4 years, he's been traveling, not all the time, but he's been making it possible for us to travel, right up into Queensland to dance. All the different communities to tell their story, their creation of their part of the river. And that's Roger Davis from the Murray-Darling Basin Authority. He's travelled with us a couple of times. He knows about the river. He knows the stories. He's been there. He's camped alongside of us. The cultural side of the river, the cultural side of this land, as Aboriginal people and as Ngarrindjeri, we put that first. We put our mother, the earth, first. Because we all come from the earth. Doesn't matter where we come from. We all come from there. And then we go back to her. Our life, our journey through life sometimes could be a very, very rough run. Sometimes smooth. The rivers that we travel. I was born down on Lake Alexandrina, on Raukan. I lived there. I went to school there. I grew up to nearly a teenager, and then we had to move. We had to move to another community. But I remember the river. I remember the lakes, the fishing, the stories that my grandmother told me. We'd go and do fishing. We'd go and say, well, okay, she said, well, you go to that part of it. There's this type of fish that live there. And you go around here and there's this type of yabby there. And then you go over here in this area here and this is where they live in the holds. The yabbies live in the holds. And all different types of fish. It's like a multicultural community down in the water. You got the fish, you got certain types of fish live here. Because the yellow belly don't like living with this mob, so they all live together. And they feed there because that's where their food is. And over the last couple hundred years, it's been all mixed up. You look at how Auntie Beryl Carmichael, she says, how the water was. I remember the Koorong when we went fishing. You can see the fish swimming into the nets. You can't do that now. It's all a funny colour right through. Dancing the spirit back into the land. Dancing the spirit back into ourselves. And then inviting other nations to come with us. To learn about the country they live in. To learn about
who they live next to. And I always think, you know, people, you live in this country, how many people here speak Ngunnawa? How many people speak a language that you live up in Queensland? How many people speak another language where your hometown is of that group? Learn about the stories. Learn about the language. Sing the songs. Be involved. And I know that people need that river, need that water for survival, economic base. I know they need it for their crops. I know they need it for their farms. But if we've got no water to drink to keep us alive, them farms and crops and that, they're not worth nothing because we won't be here. You got no water to drink and you got no fresh water, healthy water to keep you going, your body. We die. And the Ngarindiri got that inside, that spirit, and we all got that spirit inside of us. But the Ngarindiri called that the miwi. And that tells us if we're doing something wrong. If we're doing something wrong to ourselves or another community, or doing something wrong about the land. Your spirit tells you. But I think some people, they built a little thing inside of them that overrides that spirit. Nah, they'll be all right. But as Aboriginal people of this land, we know it's not going to be all right. We know of the stories that's been handed down to us for thousands of years. That's why when we've done the ceremony, we've been doing that for thousands of years, connecting up, because river people, we come under one law. Our law of that land, our law of that river, we're under that one law. And we practice it. Not many people that's non-Aboriginal recognize our law or honor our law. But we still do. As Aboriginal people, we have to live in two worlds. We live in our world and we live in the westernized world. Because we're all involved in that 9-to-5 work. We're all involved in different meetings. We're all involved in trying to convince people that this is the way to go. How many people live along the river? Thousands, millions of people live along the rivers, right through the country. But how many of them know the creation stories? How many of them know the songs that are sung at certain places? The songs we sing is not just a song you pull out of the air and say, oh, well, we'll sing it here. Next year we'll sing it over there. No. Them songs are about the land. They're about our connection to the stars, our connection to the wind, the trees, the sand, the animals. Ngarindiri got a word. We say ngachi. Ngachi is... it means friend, your closest friend. And to us, the plants, the animals, you're like a totem, similar to a totem. That's our closest friend, that river. Some of us got that river as our closest friend, the water, little creeks, the fish that live in them little creeks, all these, where they call swamps. I think I heard Sarah say that about the swamps, the breeding places. Without them there, There's a man in our community, he says that's the nurseries for all the little fish that comes back into the water. They're there. Mangrove swamps around the oceans and that. A lot of the life for the ocean starts there. And yet people want to knock them down, fill them in, build buildings on top of them. A lot of the towns that was built in this country, a lot of the towns that get flooded every year. You see it on the TV. People crying around, ripping their carpets up, pushing all the mud and dirt out of their front lounge room, pushing it down the passage. Their windows have broken, the bedrooms are, the cupboards are floating around in the house. Every year that happens, that tells you one thing. You've built your house on a floodplain. You know, I thought a lot of people were smart. The smartest thing you could have done or can do in the future is talk to us. Talk to the Aboriginal people of that country, right where you live. Because you'll notice some of the old people that lived, they lived up on high rises. People say, oh, nothing, that's all right, we'll build down here. They lived up there for a reason. Every now and again, the water will flood. How many times have water been and cars been cruising through Brisbane, you know? All the different places, Ningen, you know, every town called Ningen? Yeah. You could fish in your lounge room there certain times a year. Yeah, you'll catch a lot of fish there too. Yeah, so we know the stories of this country. We've been here for thousands and thousands of years. I go on ceremonies every year. Not the river ceremony. I go on other ceremonies with other different groups. We start from the Kurung. And we finish up right up in the desert. About 500 miles, I think, other side of Uluru. Right up there. And the songs are sung and water is shown in different places. Where if you're thirsty, you go here and you dig a little hole and you sing and you hit the ground. And in a few minutes, the water will start coming up. And these are in dry riverbeds. So when we talk about culture, we talk about an ancient culture, ancient stories. Stories of a long time ago that are still current today, that are still very powerful today. That's what I'm involved in, along with other groups as you see there. My grandchildren, there was only a few of them on the bus. I got 24 grandchildren, you know? 3 great-grandchildren. I got 9 children. And they're all involved in culture. We'll be dancing, doing that ceremony here on the 30th of September. We're coming up and we're dancing up at the Snowy Mountains. We're dancing down, not right on there. I don't want to get too cold. I know this is cold country, but we want to dance up there. And we want to be involved in the group from here, the Ngunnawal people. So they can be involved in our ceremonies about the river, dancing, being a part. And it's open for everyone to come. Everyone. There'll be flyers put out, and Adrian Brown told me that he'd put some information out. As I'm sure Lindy Allen will put some information out so that people know exactly and where about and what time. And dancing will start just on sunset. That's how we do our ceremonies. We invite our ancestors. We invite everyone and their ancestors to be there on the 30th. And we start on the Murrumbidgee, come down and then back here into Canberra. So my reason for seeing that river healthy is a different reason than what we've heard today and what we'll hear in the future. My reason is a cultural reason. First and foremost is we look after ourselves, then we look after other things. Because if we don't look after ourselves in a physical, spiritual, and mental state, then there's no way we can look after anything else. So rather than put the farms and that up here, you put them down here and you put yourself up there. Because if we can't keep healthy ourselves, there's no way we can help anyone else in a physical and mental state, in a spiritual state. And that's where culture comes into it. Because all the farms, if you're not healthy in that, if you're down here waiting for the water, and all the farms are up here, we'll all be dead. The farms will be, the animals will take over the farms, if they're around. But they need water too. And we need fresh water to live. And if that spirit leaves us, it's like I said there, we're nothing. We're dead inside. We need to keep that me-we, that spirit going. We need to keep the spirit inside of us that tells us that we're doing the right thing or that we're doing the wrong thing. And we all have to be responsible, not just us as Aboriginal people. Everyone have to be responsible for that river, for that land that they live on. Some people say to me sometimes, but what about the white people? What are they going to do? I said, well, you could rest assured. I said, write this down. I said, they're not going home. They're staying here. So they have to be involved too. They have to come and dance with us. I've been doing this for 4 years now. And about 3 weeks ago, I was in France. I went over there I got invited to a boomerang throwing competition. They've got their own boomerang throwing club in France. So I got invited there, me and the dancers, and we danced at a few ceremonies. But one of the men that comes from France, he comes over every year and be involved in that ceremony from Maramara all the way down to the river, down to the Murray Mouth. He travels with us. This year he brought his girlfriend. And this year they both danced with us. We painted them up and they danced with us. We taught them to dance on the way down. And they're not the only non-Aboriginal people that's done that. There was a woman from America a couple of years ago. She came across. She came as an onlooker to. I said, well, no, you're going to travel with us, so you might as well learn some of the dances. I said, I'll get my wife and my daughters to teach you. And then she danced all the way down. She lives in Denver in America. So, and I still, the other week I got an email from her. She wants to know what date next year because she's going to bring some of her friends. So there's people that's been traveling with us. A couple from here got married and they used it as their honeymoon to travel down the river with us. So it's open there for everyone to come. everyone to be a part of, even if you don't want to dance. Just come down and look and listen to the stories. But learn about this country you live in. Learn the true stories about this land, the creation stories. I think you people will be very surprised of how some of our land was created, of how the rivers were created, how the mountains, our little bush, why that little bush is there. I've done a few cultural things, and I carved cut a bark canoe out of the red gum. I floated it in different places down around in South Australia. I brought it up to Sydney, and I floated it in Darling Harbour. Doing a bit of work on it now, but I'd love to bring it up here when we come up. And float it just in one of the little rivers here, or little lakes here, or whatever, we'll bring it up. It'd be good to bring and get other people back into doing cultural stuff, shields, all the other things. These little clapsticks. It's from the Mallee, right on the Coorong. So, my reasons for being here, my reasons for talking, is entirely different. But at the end of it, it's for the same thing. Is to keep the water in this country, whether it be the Murray, the Darling, the Lachlan, the Murrumbidgee, all the little ones come into it, the Nebine Creek. Keep them healthy. And when we keep them rivers healthy, we keep ourselves and people around us, the animals and plants, we keep them healthy too. So I'd like to thank you all for listening to me, and I'd like to thank Lindy, Ellen, and One River for inviting me up and making it possible for me to be here. But also I'd like to, last of all, is thank the people here, Adrian Brown, and that for taking me up and showing me the mountains, showing me the rock paintings yesterday. It was a good day. I had a really good day looking at their cultural stuff. And there's a lot of rock art around the mountains. How many people in Canberra have been there to see them? Or to honour the people that painted them as you go? Maybe learn a song and sing that song as you walk through, letting them know that you're coming. When we sing a song and dance, we sing Pantan Ngarinyiri, and that song means Ngarinyiri coming. We do that ceremony. We're coming in to dance. We're coming in to talk. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mugi, for asking, for showing a different kind of leadership, really, and for asking us some excellent, quite elemental questions. Time is moving along, and I want to introduce our final speaker for this session, who is the multidimensional Kim Chalmers, who's a wine grower and also a composer and musician, a festival director and an environmental activist. Wears many hats, based primarily in Mildura. Kim's family company, Chalmers Wines, has introduced Italian avant-garde grape varieties new to Australia, but well-suited to dry climates and environments in which they're grown here. And the winery's also worked to greatly reduce its consumption of irrigation water from the river. As a composer, Kim has a diverse output ranging from works for solo piano to large-scale electronic and multimedia performance pieces, and her most recent major project was Conflux, which was commissioned, or supported at least, as part of the One River project, and some of you who were at Belconnen yesterday might have seen an excerpt from that work. So Kim's always impressed me as a person who can balance a whole range of professional interests with incredible dexterity. She's got a new interest in utero that she's developing at the moment that'll be keeping her busy. But anyway, for now, I've asked him to tell us a bit about the challenges of being a horticulturalist activist in her work. Please welcome Kim Chalmers.
Thanks, Malcolm. I'm from Mildura, and the area around Mildura. I grew up in that part of the world, which is sort of just downstream of where the Bidgee meets the Murray. It's a really beautiful part of the world. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I do, and I guess my talk is really focused around the concept that being an environmentalist and being an irrigator are not necessarily two separate things. And there's a lot of talk about how those two roles are so opposite to one another, but I'm standing here today to tell you that they're actually not. So, I grew up, this is the Peacock Creek, which is a creek which runs in flood times from the Bidgee through to the Murray. It used to be an old, old course of the Bidgee before it found a shorter route many thousands of years ago, and this ran through my family property. My grandfather established a broadacre farming property there on the Murray. It was on the New South Wales side near Lake Benanee many years ago, and he actually, in the 40s and 50s, approached that establishment of a farm in a very environmentally responsible way, particularly for his time. So having a real respect for nature is in my family. He cleared the Mallee in a way that was very sensitive to native bushland. He made sure he left green corridors everywhere for native wildlife and flora to maintain its presence despite the farming, and he rotated his crops in a very responsible way to keep the integrity of the soil. My father then established a part of that later on, but this growing up in this environment has inspired me in a number of ways. One of those is in my art, and this is a couple of photographs from a project that I did with Sally Hedricks, who is my collaborator on the One River project. And you can see there how the landscape of the river environment is so intricately tied in with what I do, and I find the concept that Uncle Moogie spoke of the songs being about the land, you know, I'm clearly not an Indigenous person, but I feel that, and the music that I create is always inspired from the region. So here's a little picture of the past. This was obviously part of the broadacre and grazing history of the property where my family grew up. This is an old shearing hut quarters that was located on the Peacock Creek, and that's when the creek used to flood before the dams and things were put in and locks, and they used to use paddle steamers to move things down. So moving on from that broadacre history, my father started viticulture and irrigated horticulture on a corner of the property in the 80s. And as you can see there, our vineyard's a bit different to a lot of vineyards that you see in the area in that it is full of trees. The tractor drivers hate it because they have to go around them all the time. But all of those green corridors that were originally left there by my grandfather when he cleared it for broadacre have been left there for viticulture as well. And it's a technique that we use to also keep our chemical use down, because having all those native birds and things there keeps the insects away, and we don't have to use any pesticides or anything on our crops. So keeping the land healthy indeed does keep the people healthy, and it keeps business healthy as well. Over the years of working like this in our vineyards, we've developed a whole method of sustainable viticulture where we're using less water, we're using less chemicals, but we're producing crops that are commercially viable. And, you know, the word irrigator is a bit of a dirty word at times when you're talking about the environment, but we've developed methods to be able to reduce our water use by up to half. So we're growing grapes with about half the amount of water that most other people in our district are. And I think the need to have more water for environment is absolutely essential. I'm not anti-basin plan, I'm pro-basin plan. And I think that water for rivers, water for communities, water for the environment is absolutely paramount. But that does not necessarily mean that irrigated business can't exist. And this is the cover of a DVD which we produced ourselves. I wrote the script and it was partially funded by the federal government, and it was actually distributed out to irrigated grape growers right across the Murray-Darling Basin free of charge. Thousands of copies went out. And a lot of people contacted us after we sent this around saying, thank you so much, we've done things that you talked about in this video in our farms and we've managed to save X amount of water. So it's not only about what you do in your own backyard, it's about how you share that knowledge across the basin to make everybody stand up and listen and realise that they can become more sustainable and that less water doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. So moving on from that farm that was my family property, we sold that property in 2008 and we've established two smaller vineyards now. My sister and I are heavily involved in the family business too, so we're the third generation on the land here. Our two new sites are also irrigated vineyards. This one is in Heathcote, in the northern part of Heathcote near Rochester, so it's irrigated from the Murray-Goulburn system. As you can see, we've also got plenty of native trees and things in our vineyard there as well. It's in a traditional area that was grazing and cropping. And we've established a new little vineyard in Merbein. Now, it was interesting to see the photographs of the Chafee propaganda, shall we call it. Merbein was a product of that Chafee development and, you know, it was an ambitious plan at the time, but it has created a community where people love to live. And I know when we heard from Daniel earlier about what makes places like Mildura great, it's not just irrigation. It is also the lifestyle that comes from that living in a beautiful place like that and being able to be a working artist living there. But sadly, with the changes over the last 20 years in water flows and allocations, and, you know, we all know that there's been less water during the millennium drought, there is a big change in our district, and especially in places like Merbein, where families that have been farming for a long time have had to look for other streams of income, and there's lots of dead vineyards and things like that. So there are hard times, and it's not an easy thing to navigate. We all know that. But what we've done is we've tried to really focus on the positives and see those challenges as opportunities. And so apart from just using more sustainable practices and reducing our water requirement and reducing the chemicals we're using, which is all good stuff, we've also invested a lot of research into finding out what grapes actually grow better in these hot areas. We all got a bit excited in the 70s and 80s and just decided to plant, you know, all the French varieties everywhere because that's what was popular. But actually, if you think about it, places like Mildura are hot and dry and they're much more similar to Spain or Sicily than they are to Bordeaux or Burgundy. So my family over the last 10 years, 15 years, has done a lot of research and development, and we actually imported about 70 new grape varieties into the country with a real focus on grape vines that actually love the hot, dry conditions. And this is another way that we can reduce the amount of inputs that we're having to put into our farms to create a commercial outcome. So turning challenges into positive things. Basically, these Sicilian varieties and southern Italian varieties and things are able to grow and thrive in conditions where other grape varieties perhaps don't, where you need to obviously treat them very differently. So we've spent the last 10 years working out which ones do best and making wines from those and going out and telling our story to the country one-to-one. So my sister and I sell the wines ourselves, and we go into the bars and restaurants in Melbourne, and these are fancy restaurants that are well awarded and well reviewed, and, you know, people are in there spending their hard-earned money every weekend. And they want to hear our story. They want to know that we are using less water. They want to know that we are growing varieties which suit the country better. And our brand is built on that. And it's a good news story. And there's other people that are also investing time and money into these varieties now. In the 15 years since we started doing it, a number of the varieties that of grapes that we grow are now being grown commercially all over warm inland Australia, and not only by small people like us, but by the big companies that actually guide, you know, the way that the world perceives Australian wine, like Treasury Wine Estates and brands like Jacobs Creek and things like that. This is just an example of one of the Italian varieties we grow, and places like Merbein and Sunraysia and the Riverina and the Riverland, in terms of grapes, have always been seen as a sort of a factory style grape production with big crops and lots of water and lots of grapes and, you know, and a lot of cheap product. And I just read the other day that the average value of wine exported from Australia is around about $1 a litre. If you think about what goes into that dollar, the water, the manpower, and all those people that have to make a living from that, that's unsustainable. So what we want to do is we want to improve the value of this product. We put a lot of effort and time, and there's a lot of natural resources that go into making the wine that we make, so we want people to respect that. And we've done projects like this little project, which we like to affectionately call the Bucket Wine Project. This year we made about 40 different very small batches of handmade wine. When I say handmade, there was no chemicals, there was no instruments. We had no lab equipment. We used a bucket, a sieve, a jug, and a few beer bottles and a crown sealer and a texter to write on the bottles. And we actually drove down to Melbourne with all this wine in our car, and we had a sale in a restaurant there where we invited a very short list of the top restaurants and wine bars around Melbourne to come and see what we'd done and made these wines from grape varieties that love the sun in a region that's not specifically well known for premium wine, but we put a lot of love in, and we wanted to show people you can create really beautiful, unique things with less inputs. And in 17 minutes, we sold every single bottle of wine that we took there. So people want to hear the story. They want to know what we're up to. This is just an example of a little piece of press that we got in Brisbane about those bucket wines. And you can see that the journalist here has actually said he thinks it's probably the best Pinot Grigio that he's ever tried from Australia. We made it in a bucket. So that's pretty exciting. But this is our Charmers brand, and these are the kind of varieties that we grow. And that we have taken 10 years to build our brand to a point now where there is a real level of trust in the community about what we do, because they know our story and they know the way that we approach our role as farmers and, you know, as custodians of the land in a way as well. We have a responsibility of stewardship, and we take that very seriously. And people know when they buy a bottle of Charmers wine that we've thought about all of that before that wine got in that bottle and went to their table. And we're not resting on our laurels now. We're also looking at bringing in more new grape varieties, also from hot areas, to try and really change the way that we do things and make business more sustainable. And what I really want to be able to achieve is for people to understand that irrigators and environmentalists are not enemies, they're allies, and some of us are wearing both hats. And we want balance, we want a healthy future, we want a green and prosperous future for everybody, for communities, for cultures, and for the land as well. And I think this is just one example of how we can save water, we can make a greener future, and we can make successful businesses and healthy communities all at the same time.
Thank you very much, Kim. That was inspiring, really. We wanted to end on a moment of inspiration. Now, and imagination as well, which is the other thing I'd say about that. It's a terrific story. And there are, I'm sure, a whole lot of stories like that, and why don't we ever hear more of them is a question I'd like to ask. Speaking of questions, I was hoping that there would be time for some people here to ask questions, but because Moogie spoke for so long, He was on a roll. I couldn't stop him. He was on a roll. And it was good. It was good, but it means that we've got no time for questions now because now it's 12:30 and it's lunchtime. But that's okay because we're back here this afternoon and there will be scope for some questions, I think, in the sessions that Barbara and George are running. So what happens now is that there's lunch downstairs in the hall that we're happily providing for all of you. There's also some films of mine that are playing on a screen if anyone wants to have a look at those. There's also an opportunity, I understand, to go outside and visit the PS Enterprise, which is conveniently moored at the gate of the museum here, and to have a look at that down by the lake. And then there's also going to be a little bit of music, a little musical moment that will happen at the end of lunch that will be a cue for you to come back inside and come back here for these two sessions this afternoon facilitated by Barbara Paulson and by George Main, involving a group of artists, as I mentioned earlier, who have been involved in the One River Project, talking about their work, but also talking about that in relation to some themes suggested by particular artefacts from the museum collections, and we hope there'll be some time for some questions from the floor in the course of those two sessions.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.